I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Tom Weidlinger, author of The Restless Hungarian. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benicot. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We celebrated Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day, about 10 days ago. I should note that Palestinians have a very different take on this date. They call it the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic. That phrase, sadly, can be used to describe many moments in Palestinian history over the past century, and some comments by a freshman congresswoman last week give us an opportunity on Two Jewish to review facts and history and perhaps open some eyes to the reality around the founding of the only Jewish state in the world. Last weekend, Michigan freshman Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib made comments about Israel, Palestinian sacrifice, and the Holocaust that were extremely controversial and demonstrated ignorance of history or an addiction to alternative facts. Tlaib's insensitivity was disappointing, although not shocking from a Palestinian-descended politician who has previously made anti-Israel remarks. Tlaib was being interviewed on a Yahoo podcast last week when she was asked about her support for a one-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She noted the recent observance of Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, before veering into the historic position of the State of Israel. These are Tlaib's exact words. "There's kind of a calming feeling I always tell folks when I think of the Holocaust and the tragedy of the Holocaust and the fact that it was my ancestors, Palestinians, who lost their land and some lost their lives, their livelihood, their human dignity, their existence in many ways have been wiped out and some people's passports," Tlaib said. Continuing, "I mean, just all of it was in the name of trying to create a safe haven for Jews, post the Holocaust, post the tragedy, and the horrific persecution of Jews across the world at that time. And I love the fact that it was my ancestors that provided that, right, in many ways. But they didn't in a way that took their human dignity away, right, and it was forced on them. And so when I think about a one state, I think about the fact that why couldn't we do it in a better way?" Well, putting aside the fact that I have never before heard anyone say that thinking about the Holocaust provoked a calming feeling, thinking about the brutal genocide of 6 million innocent people, including 2 million children, should not be calming to anyone sane. Even put aside the fact that Jews have claimed Israel as our historical homeland for 3,000 years, that we had a nation there long ago, and that we had a vibrant community in Israel well before World War II. What Rashida Tlaib clearly meant was that she felt the annihilation of the Jews of Europe and the desire to provide the survivors with a safe haven was the sole reason Israel was voted into formal existence by the UN, and that the dislocation of her Palestinian ancestors was a result of the world's desire to atone for the Shoah. Well, the world doesn't have such a strong guilt complex, and those aren't the facts, of course. But in her mind, that relieved some of the angst she feels about the troubled and often disastrous fate of the Palestinian Arabs since that time. But Tlaib made it sound as though the Arabs living in British Palestine in the 1940s sacrificed their own aspirations in order to help the survivors of the worst genocide in human history, the Jews, after the Holocaust. She framed it as a noble sacrifice her Arab ancestors made to create a safe haven for Jews. That is not what happened. The Arab history of the 20s, 30s, and 40s in British Palestine is best illustrated by the career of its most prominent leader and spokesperson for all three of those decades, Amin al-Husseini, Grand Mufti of Jerusalem from 1921 to 1948. He was appointed by the British Empire to a post in charge of the Muslim holy places in Jerusalem, and for almost 30 years he was the titular and public head of the Arabs in Palestine. The British controlled Israel from 1917 until the UN partition resolution in 1947. The British withdrawal precipitated the Arab invasion and the Israeli War of Independence in 1948. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Husseini, was a fervent Arab nationalist. Today we might call him a Palestinian, a term that was not even applied to Arabs until the mid-1960s. Anyway, the Mufti deliberately incited murderous riots against Jews in Palestine in the 1920s and 30s and virulently resisted all Jewish immigration into the Yishuv, the Jewish settlement in Palestine, throughout his tenure. The Mufti was the leader of the Arab riots and the full-on Arab revolt against the British in Palestine from 36 to 1939, which directly targeted and murdered Jews. After fleeing the British hangman, the Mufti allied himself closely with Hitler throughout World War II and lived in Third Reich Berlin through the end of the war as Hitler's valued guest and employee. During World War II, the Mufti collaborated with Italy and Germany, making many propaganda radio broadcasts and helping the Nazis recruit Bosnian Muslims for the Waffen-SS, the German military unit with primary responsibility for murdering Jews. On meeting Adolf Hitler, the Mufti requested backing for Arab independence and opposition to the establishment of any Jewish national home in Palestine. He introduced radical, vicious anti-Semitism into Arab nationalism and permanently associated the Palestinian national movement with European-style, Nazi-flavored anti-Semitism. The Mufti declared in November 1943, "It is the duty of Muslims in general and Arabs in particular to drive all Jews from Arab and Mohammedan countries. Germany is also struggling against the common foe who oppressed Arabs and Mohammedans in their different countries. It has very clearly recognized the Jews for what they are and resolved to find a final solution for the Jewish danger that will eliminate the scourge that Jews represent in the world." The Mufti also collaborated with the Nazis in numerous sabotage and commando operations in Iraq, Transjordan, and Palestine. Repeatedly, he urged the Germans to bomb Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, to injure Palestinian Jewry, and for propaganda purposes in the Arab world, as his Nazi interlocutors wrote. Those proposals were rejected as unfeasible by the Nazis. Employed by Hitler's regime as chief propagandist to the Muslim world, the Mufti, Amin al-Husseini, recognized leader of what today we call Palestinian Arabs, was paid the equivalent of $12 million annually in the 1940s by Hitler's regime to make radio broadcasts like this one in March of 1944 when he said, "Arabs, rise as one man and fight for your sacred rights. Kill the Jews wherever you find them. This pleases God, history, and religion. This saves your honor. God is with you." At the end of World War II, the Mufti tried to flee the collapse of Nazi Germany for Switzerland and political asylum, but was arrested by the Allies as a war criminal. The French allowed him to escape prosecution, and he fled to Egypt. He was expected to become the leader of the new Arab state after the UN partition of Palestine. The Mufti, Amin al-Husseini, totally opposed any immigration of Holocaust refugees into Palestine, a position taken by all the Palestinian leadership and all Arab states, and enforced by the British. Of course, the Arab states surrounding Israel universally opposed its creation, and in 1948 launched a multi-front invasion of Israel as soon as it declared independence. But the Mufti never became the leader of a new Arab state because he was outmaneuvered by the head of the already created brand new nation of Jordan, King Abdullah. Jordan had a Palestinian majority and no desire to see Amin al-Husseini in power. King Abdullah annexed all the West Bank and East Jerusalem territory that was supposed to be part of the new Palestinian Arab state. The subsequent 1948 Arab War of Aggression and invasion against Israel resulted in a stunning and miraculous victory for the fledgling State of Israel over large Arab armies and Palestinian Arab irregular forces. That defeat, considered cataclysmic by Arabs, permanently discredited the Mufti, removing him from the levers of power and influence with the Palestinian Arabs. That's exactly how willingly Palestinians welcomed Holocaust survivors fresh from death camps and internment and detention centers into Israel. It's not clear why Rashida Tlaib thinks her Palestinian ancestors helped create a refuge for Holocaust victims, when in fact, the Arabs in Palestine and throughout the Arab world fought viciously to keep any Jews from coming to British Palestine from 1920 on. They made certain many Jews were unable to find refuge from the Nazi genocide and ultimately were sent to the death camps. In the land itself, the Arabs often rioted and tried to slaughter the Jews who were there, who had to defend themselves against their own neighbors. Tlaib did not specify what she thinks her ancestors did to help Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi genocide, except to have Jews forced on them. Tlaib famously advocates a one-state solution, a joint Palestinian-Israeli commonwealth forcing the two peoples into one country. When asked if that could be seen as reckless, she replied, "No, I'm coming from a place of love, for equality and justice. I want a safe haven for Jews," she added. "Who doesn't want to be safe? I am humbled by the fact that it was my ancestors that had to suffer for that to happen. I will not turn my back and allow others to hijack it and say that it's some extremist approach because they're coming from a place of, whatever it is, division, inequality." Danny Danon, Israel's ambassador to the UN, tweeted at the Congresswoman, "Rashida Tlaib, your words are both grossly anti-Semitic and ignorant. You should take some time to learn history before trying to rewrite it." Tlaib's comments quickly became fodder for top Republicans and right-wing websites. President Donald Trump said the comments were horrible and highly insensitive and demonstrated a tremendous hatred of Israel and the Jewish people. Tlaib has come under fire repeatedly for her past comments and positions on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and her comments on this Yahoo podcast, while frequently misrepresented online, join a growing list of statements that galvanize many people against her. Look, Rashida Tlaib doesn't matter. She's just one freshman congresswoman in an ineffective U.S. legislative body, a house of 534 people. She's clearly an Arabist and Palestinian advocate. We've had a few in Congress before like that, even if they weren't female Muslims, and her actual influence there is truly minimal. Is Tlaib's ahistorical take on Israel and the Palestinians accurate? Not at all. Is it dangerous? Only if it influences people about the situation today. The history of the Arab people in the West Bank and Gaza over the past century is truly disastrous. While many of those disasters have been self-inflicted, that does not temper their terrible situation. The idea that a one-state solution, some sort of shared Israel-Palestine, would work for the benefit of all is a hallucination. And the insistence that the responsibility for creating a Palestinian state rests solely on Israel, the one small Jewish state in a region filled with huge Arab nations, is beyond reason. Sadly, there remain many people in the Middle East, especially Gaza, who think the way the Mufti did back in the 1940s. There are certainly people in Europe who think that way, and there are even some in America who agree with them, like Rashida Tlaib. Most Palestinians are simply people who wish to live in peace and safety with the possibility of upward mobility. They would like sovereignty over their own homes. Most do not believe they will ever destroy Israel or conquer its lands, and most have no desire to slaughter Jews. These are the people who can and should have their own nation. Unfortunately, we are now about as far from the dream of a successful Palestinian state as we have ever been. I can't imagine a new Middle East peace initiative supposed to emanate from the White House in June will change that. And that is truly tragic. But this is not because the noble Palestinians sacrificed their right to self-determination to create a Jewish refugee state in 1948, or ever. And making up a dramatic false history that pretends this does not make it so. To play us in this morning in honor of Lag BaOmer, a minor but beautiful Jewish holiday coming up Wednesday night and Thursday, here's a Sephardic song celebrating Shimon Bar Yochai, whose mystical heritage is celebrated on Lag BaOmer at Mount Meron in the Galilee in Israel. Bar Yochai, nimshachta ashrecha, shemetza somecha berecha. Bar Yochai, nimshachta ashrecha, shemetza somecha berecha. Thank you.
Shabbat be'erechat. Bar Yochai, Moshav Tov Yashavta, Yom Nasta, Yom Asher Barachta. Min Ma'arat, Zorim She'amadta, Sham Kanita, Otcha Badarecha.
That was Dudu Dari singing Bar Yochai for Lag BaOmer this coming week. Our guest this morning, Tom Weidlinger, has written a memoir that is really an exploration of the remarkable life of his father, a Holocaust survivor and cold warrior of great distinction, but whom he himself had to discover much later in a unique way, including the very fact of his Judaism. Hear that remarkable story when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Tom Weidlinger is the author of the new book, The Restless Hungarian, Modernism, Madness, and the American Dream. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the long genesis of this book and this project.
Oh, good Lord. How to tell it in a short amount of time. I knew 5 years ago that I was curious to make a film about my father because he had really an extraordinary life of adventures. And as a filmmaker, I started out to make a documentary film about him and his adventures in Europe and in Bolivia and coming to the States and becoming a major structural engineer and architect. But as the project evolved, it moved from being a film to a book, and it became a deeper excavation than I had initially imagined.
You know, it's fascinating. First of all, the opening of the book's pretty good, talking about your dad's stories. He taught himself to read at the age of 4, was a communist when he was 14, arrested and sentenced to death at 18, slept under bridges in Paris, apprenticed to Le Corbusier, almost got your mother arrested by the Gestapo, made and lost a fortune in Bolivia, started a world-renowned company in New York to pay for your mother's insane asylum bills. I mean, kind of crazy, crazy story. And a good friend of Dr. Strangelove. How do you tell all that?
It was a challenge because there's really three story arcs to his story, which is why I decided to write a book rather than make a film. The first is the story of a man, a Hungarian, who came from an upper middle class Jewish family and who fled Hungary first because of he was part of an underground communist movement, and then fled Europe because of the Holocaust. And when he came to this country, completely hid his identity as a Jew. And no one in our family ever knew about it. And I just discovered it by error when I was visiting relatives in Hungary. So that discovery of this sort of hidden identity was partly what triggered the writing of the book, because suddenly things seemed to fall into place. There were sort of gaps in his account of himself and decisions that he made, which didn't make sense, but suddenly did make sense when I knew that he was a Jew. So that's one story, the story of a person who hid their identity and the consequences of it, which some were survival, but I think in a way he cut off a part of himself and that sort of got passed down. Another story is the story of a man who was a genius, who was a sort of fearless entrepreneur, architect, structural engineer, who came to this country, worked with some of the greatest architects of the mid-20th century, and then became a cold warrior, working with the RAND Corporation and the Defense Nuclear Agency to build silos for intercontinental ballistic missiles that could withstand a Russian first strike. So that was the story of the professional man. And then the third story was the man who was my father and my mother's husband, which was greatly complicated by the fact that my mother developed schizophrenia, and so how the family dealt with that stress is the third story.
We will explore those stories in much greater depth when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish with Tom Weidlinger. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community striving every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, just across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell. Shabbat services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah study is at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, and rich array of adult education academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest and fastest growing Jewish community in Southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We're talking about Morocco. You're leading a trip to Morocco and Spain, a kind of Jewish heritage trip. And I had an incredible experience there where I found the last Jewish shofar maker in Morocco, in Marrakesh.
Right. And this is such a great story that even though we were just about to transition to Spain, I wish you would tell the story, at least briefly, because it's a fabulous story about, you know, what's left of what was once a huge, thriving, important Jewish community.
Right. So I went on this trip with a group of rabbis some years ago. We went to Casablanca, Fez, Rabat, Marrakesh. I kept asking the guy, our guide, where I could find some shofars, because I wanted to bring one, some back to people in my congregation. I knew there was beautiful Moroccan shofars. They're a little different than the other ones you see. And eventually, on the very last day of the trip, I ended up leaving from a spice market in the Melech of Marrakesh and riding on the back of a small Motobacan scooter with a very large Arab with whom I did not share any linguistic affinities, through all the back, twisted, dark, dirty alleys of Marrakesh. And we ended up finding the place where they actually manufacture these, three guys on the floor.
And I'm sure that as you were bouncing along, your head was full of paranoid fantasies about what could happen to you.
I thought they'd find my body years later.
Throat slit, whatever.
Exactly, all of that. And it turned out none of that, of course, was true. It was scary just riding. And then we ended up finding this place, and I purchased a Moroccan shofar and a shofar box, beautiful one made out of shofar horn, brought back a bunch of other shofars, both for people in my congregation and then the other rabbis on the trip I was on. And they're really quite gorgeous. They kind of look like the walls of Marrakesh, crenellated, you know.
But as I recall,
like
you didn't you weren't able to buy it directly when you were in the shop.
No, no, no.
And schlep it back with you on the Moto Bican.
Correct. There was
yet another dramatic step in
the
story.
Yeah, he had to bring him to the hotel our very last night in Marrakesh. And I think I paid $13 a shofar or something. I mean, some ridiculously low price. But they're beautiful. I still have it. I still use it and use it to illustrate the different qualities. But also fascinating because it was such a unique element of the Moroccan Jewish community. I mean, their shofars are different from any I've seen anywhere else in the world. Beautiful. And part of what was once an incredibly vital Jewish community. And now, you know, it's kind of remnants, but here they were still making them.
Right. And when you first told me this story, there were three guys working in the workshop that produced
That's correct.
And the question is, you know, who is their market? There's like virtually no Jewish community left in Morocco. There's a number of Israeli tourists and probably Jewish tourists. But do these three guys really have a full-time business catering to a few Jewish tourists per year?
Look, there was a boss, too. I mean, it was a whole industry. Very small, but I'm assuming that the Jewish tourists do get it, or somehow or other, Morocco, which I'm sure doesn't have direct commercial relations with Israel, sends some of these to, who knows, Djerba or somewhere, and it gets sent on to Israel, and they sell them in Israel. Although I haven't actually seen these in Israel, these particular ones.
Well, it's an interesting question, and one of the many mysteries of many places in the world where there was once a huge, thriving Jewish community, and now just a tiny remnant.
Yeah. And somehow, sometimes those remnants give us some remarkable spark still.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. David has done very well for himself. He's now the mayor of a town in Israel. One day, David and his wife Rivka are walking past a construction site. Suddenly, one of the construction workers calls out, "What's new, Rivka?" "Ah, why, it's nice to see you again, Avi," Rivka replies. She introduces David, the mayor, her husband, to the construction worker. After David and Rivka walk away, he asks her how she knows Avi. "Oh," Rivka says, "we went to school together. I thought about marrying him." David laughs. "You don't realize how lucky you are. If I hadn't come along, today you'd be the wife of a construction worker." And Rivka replies without hesitation, "Not really. If I had married him, he'd be the mayor." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our young representatives of Israel, Ron Benakoth and Rotem Rappaport. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So it's kind of summer. I mean, in Arizona, for sure, it's summer, and the school is going to be out in a couple of days. Kids go off to summer camp. American Jewish kids tend to go to American Jewish camps. But in Israel, the sleepaway camp phenomenon isn't in any way so common, although I understand that some Israelis go abroad, actually, to go to summer camp.
So, yeah, we don't really have camps, like sleepaway camps in Israel. We have some, but the more popular ones are outside of Israel, like America or Europe. So a lot of kids do that, but it's still not as popular, I guess, as it is here.
Well, you were saying a friend of yours goes every year to Starvash, which is the Jewish summer sleepaway camp in Hungary, of all places. Yeah. Very good camp, but very interesting. And other people go with their parents if their parents are working for the summer.
Yeah.
A
lot of people
camp.
That I know went to, like, came here to the U.S. for Jewish day camp. I'm sorry.
Now you know where
camp.
Those Israeli counselors and kids come from at your kids' summer camp, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think it's like? I mean, you guys are working a day camp over the summer, right? And you'll be working about 20 hours a day, I think, at that day camp, from my experience. Camps always work you ridiculously hard and pay you very little, but you have a great time.
Thank you for...
I wanted to warn you in advance.
Yeah.
You're not the first Shin Shinim that we've had in this community.
Right.
I see what they do to you. In the process of that, what do you find out? What do you think that experience is like from an Israeli perspective, as opposed to like Americans? Oh, I met someone named Rotem. You know, I never met anybody like that before. What's the Israeli perspective on connecting with Jewish kids you know, 24 hours a day in that way.
So I think that being in a Jewish camp outside of Israel is pretty amazing, and you can see how important it is for them to keep it Jewish and to do Jewish stuff, and they're going to have an Israel day, and they're going to have Kabbalah Shabbat every Friday.
And a competition, whatever they call it, right?
Yeah, so I think I'm really excited to see how it's going to be, like, how we're going to make it.
How are you going to make it Israel in America?
Yeah, how are we going to make it in America, and how are we going to cooperate the Jewish experience and, the, of course, like camp experience. I guess a lot of Jewish kids have that here when they do day camps and sleepaway camps. And it's my first time, and I'm really excited to see like how it is combined.
Yeah, absolutely. Run, this is your first time too doing this. What do you think as you in advance?
So I'm really excited. I think it's going to be an awesome experience, something that I could never experience anywhere and any different time. And I mean, I know it'll probably be a lot, like you said, you know, in terms of the hours, but I'm 100% sure that we're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to meet new kids, new counselors, that we're going to, you know, become our friends. So I'm just excited for it. I think it's going to be a great experience.
Well, I hope it's great. I'm sure it will be. And just try to get at least a few hours sleep a night.
Okay.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bahar from the book of Leviticus, which establishes rules for the sabbatical and jubilee years, the most important form of environmental legislation in the ancient world. Concern for the environment in Judaism has always been an important part of our tradition. The very first text on caring for the natural world goes back to the opening chapters of Genesis, where we are commanded to be stewards of God's creation. But the most important Jewish legislation in the Torah is found in Leviticus. In a section we read this week in Bahar, "You shall have a sabbatical every seventh year, and the land shall rest. We're instructed to do no active planting or cultivation, to allow fields to lie fallow, give the earth a chance to rest. This is considered today to be good, practical agricultural policy. It allows time for nature to restore the nutrients that grains leach from the soil, allows the fallen fruit in the orchards to nourish the loam. It's a fundamental part of crop rotation in all areas practicing modern farming techniques." The remarkable fact about this Shemitah, the sabbatical mitzvah, is that it originated in the Torah, a document at least 2,500 years old that contains text that's quite probably 700 or 800 years older than that. That is, the scientific concern for the health of the environment goes back 3,000 years in Judaism, and the requirement to care for the natural world as responsible human beings is at least as long-standing. There are many more commandments in the Torah relating to stewardship of the natural world. Even in warfare, we're prohibited from destroying our enemy's fruit trees or seriously damaging the productive capacity of the land to feed its inhabitants. This was in sharp contrast to the ancient Roman Empire's policy of sowing salt on the fields of conquered enemies to destroy them and force them into starvation. Ironically, it's also in contrast to the occasional policy of the Israeli military to bulldoze the olive trees of Arab terrorists' families. The injunction is clear. We are to respect the natural environment since it is a reflection of God's holiness projected in our world. It is also a not-so-subtle hint that we need to seek other kinds of renewable sources of energy, such as solar power, geothermal, wind power, that do not damage the world God gives us. As the earth overheats and greenhouse gases destroy our climate permanently, we have a responsibility to work hard to reverse this process. A great lesson in a world in which we often seem more intent on domination than cultivation. A reminder that even renewable resources need tending. May we learn Bahar's lesson and allow our land to renew itself and save our only livable planet before it is too late to do so. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Tom Weidlinger, will explore his father's unique story, how he came to terms with it in a meaningful way. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel's webcast of the first Eurovision Song Contest semifinal was hacked for a few minutes with images of bombs exploding in Tel Aviv set to ominous music. The Cannes national broadcaster, which is hosting Eurovision in Tel Aviv, blamed the terror group Hamas for this hack. It did not affect the regular TV broadcast of the International Eurovision contest, just the webcast. Earlier this month, Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza fired 700 rockets at Israel, saying they hoped it would disrupt Eurovision. Also last week, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City announced it will not accept any new gifts from members of the Sackler family linked to the company that produces OxyContin, which is accused of fomenting the opioid crisis. The museum takes a position of gratitude and respect to those who support us, but on occasion we feel it's necessary to step away from gifts that are not in the public interest or the institution's interests, said Daniel H. Weiss, the president of the Met. The decision follows similar announcements by the Guggenheim Museum in New York and the Tate Museum in London. The museum will not, however, remove the family's name from its Sackler wing, which houses the famed Temple of Dendur. Also last week, the American Museum of Natural History said it has stopped accepting Sackler donations. Members of the Sackler family have been accused of directing their pharmaceutical firm, Purdue Pharma, to mislead doctors and patients about the dangers of the opioid painkiller OxyContin produced by the company. More than 200,000 people have died in the U.S. from overdoses involving prescription opioids. Purdue Pharma has been the target of numerous lawsuits. Last week, Pennsylvania became the 39th state to sue Purdue Pharma for damages caused by the overprescription of OxyContin. That's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. Welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Tom Weidlinger. The book is called The Restless Hungarian. It's really his father's biography, but of course his own experience is intimately tied up with it. Tom, your dad hid his Jewishness, a Holocaust survivor, not the only one to hide his Jewishness. But boy, it's kind of, that must have been an unbelievable shock when that came out. Although, as you said earlier, it kind of put a lot of pieces together for you.
Yes. I actually, the day that I discovered it was, I think, in 1982. I was spending some time with a Hungarian cousin that I just met, who was actually named after my father. And he took me to the synagogue on Dohány Street.
The famous Dohány Street synagogue. Yeah, it's an incredible place.
Yeah. And we went inside, and there was this memorial, a Holocaust memorial, and there was a case of documents, which he pointed out to me, and which I didn't understand because they were all in Hungarian.
Of course.
But he thought they were of particular importance, and he said, these are documents that Jews used to change their identity to Christians to attempt to evade the roundups in 1944. And I said to him, well, this is really interesting. I said, are you Jewish? And he looked at me and he said, of course I'm Jewish, and so are you.
Oh, my God.
I said, what are you talking about? And then he took me back to his apartment, got out an old shoebox, and sent me similar documents for my grandparents, false documentation, and all the birth certificates of the family where everyone was identified as
Jewish.
As Israelite.
As Israeli. What did you think?
Well, I was kind of numbed by it. And, you know, I was determined to confront my father with this. He was in his 70s, and we lived in different ends of the country. I went to see him for his 70th birthday, and you know, I was going to say, hey, Dad, we're Jewish, you know, like, what's the deal here? And but at the last minute, I just was very kind of gentle, and I said, you know, hey, Dad, I heard this strange story that we might be Jewish, you know. And his face decomposed. It was like there was this astonishing look of fear on his face. Mm. And it was just for like 15 seconds. And then he sort of smiled and he said, "Oh no, you know, we're not Jewish. We were descended from Seventh Day Adventists who immigrated from Transylvania," which I knew to be a lie. But he was so traumatized, obviously traumatized, when I just asked him the question that I never pursued it with him. And all the story of his background in the book comes from other documented sources after his death.
You know, there's a whole generation of Hungarian Jews who migrated either before the war, during the war, after the war, who helped shape American culture in some fascinating ways. The story that you tell and your dad's story is unique, I think, in some ways because of, first of all, his denial of that Jewish heritage. Most people knew about that for most of the people that came. But also because he ends up becoming, you know, super high security clearance. He's fighting the Cold War, like, fascinating stuff. But it must have made for a very weird home life.
Yes. I remember, I mean, I write about this in the book. Herman Kahn, who wrote a book called On Thermonuclear War, and who was a nuclear war planner for the RAND Corporation, would come to our apartment when I was a child. And he was an immense person, about 350 pounds. And I was always afraid that he would break our furniture if he sat on it. But he was also, even as a child, you know, I couldn't have explained it to myself then, but he was really scary. And he was the guy that became the model for Dr. Strangelove in Stanley Kubrick's film.
I always thought it was Wernher von Braun, but, you know, what do
no,
I know?
No, it was, and it was actually in his book On Thermonuclear War that Herman Kahn posited the idea of a doomsday machine, which, you know, which would destroy the world in a nuclear holocaust.
Right.
And he then became, you know, one of the loudest voices in the RAND Corporation arguing against a nuclear test ban treaty, you know, at the time that might actually have made a difference. There was a sort of window of opportunity when we discovered that the Soviet nuclear missile arsenal was not 700 missiles as the Air Force had predicted. It was only four. And we could have actually, you know, stood down our own development of nuclear weapons and created a treaty with the Soviet Union, but we didn't at that point. And Kahn was one of the people that argued against that.
Your dad's survival in the war, anybody's survival in the war, was complicated. What were the biggest surprises when you began to discover all this stuff?
Well, the biggest surprises were what had happened to the family that had that was left behind. You know, I went back to Hungary and I interviewed my cousins. We had shared the same grandparents, and they had many relatives died in Auschwitz. My closest relatives, my grandfather, Andor Weidlinger, was able to, he spent a fortune in bribes to keep his daughter from being sent to Auschwitz. And then he was able to procure a Swedish Schutz pass, these passes that were issued by Raoul Wallenberg.
Wallenberg, yeah, of course.
Yeah. And that worked for a while until the last years of the war, when the government was gone and was replaced by the Hungarian Arrow Cross, who were just right. These fanatics who would just hunt and shoot Jews on sight in the street. And so my grandfather, my step-grandmother, my step-grandsister, you know, basically weathered out the siege of Budapest living in a hole in the ground underneath a building. I discovered all this, you know, when I went to Hungary. I never had a hint of it talking to my father. And clearly he knew the story. Because his sister had visited him in 1946. But there must have been a tremendous guilt, you know, about having escaped. and you know what had happened to his family.
Mm. The you know, the in the book you go back into kind of the history of Budapest and to some degree your family, and so far, I mean, you reconstruct it, what it must have been like in the early years of the 20th century up until, you know, the beginning of the of World War II. And of course, the Hungarian Jewish community is one of the last ones to be deported because of its collaboration, because of the government's collaboration with the Nazis. All of it is really based on your own research, right? None of it came from your dad.
Correct.
In doing that, did you feel like you were sort of recovering his life a bit?
Absolutely.
You had a challenging relationship with him, I think that's fair to say, right?
It's fair to say.
In part because of your sister's suicide. You document that. You talk about that in the book. Did this help you kind of heal some of that?
Very much so. I think that you know, I actually say at the end of the first chapter in the book that this discovery that he was a Jew, you know, led me to see him with compassion. And, you know, because I hated him as a teenager. I really disagreed with his politics during the Cold War. He was not an exemplary father. But when I saw what he'd gone through to survive, and the choices that he'd made, and how he almost had to cut off parts of himself in order to survive, or at least he thought that he did.
Maybe not almost. I mean, he did cut off parts of himself.
He did, yeah, yeah.
Right.
And so, you know, seeing him in the sort of historical and cultural context of his times, not just, you know, through the eyes of his son looking at his father, it's like, okay, I get it. You know, I get what was going on.
So you're a filmmaker.
I am, yeah.
How do you turn this into, I mean, it could be a film, should be, no?
Well, it will be a film, actually. And I'm going back to Hungary this summer to work with a Hungarian film crew to recreate some impressionistic scenes from my father's childhood, and also to recreate some impressionistic scenes from my own childhood. And those are the kind of final pieces in the production puzzle before I start editing the film, which is primarily a documentary, but, you know, with these little kind of recreations, which are psychological turning points in the film. And you know, how do you make a film about this book? Well, clearly you don't make a film about a whole book. When I finished the manuscript, I sent it to a friend of mine who is a really good filmmaker who I respect, and I said, "Don, I'm too close to this. If you were to make a film, what parts of the book would you choose?" And he said and chose, he basically wrote an outline which focused on the family dynamic, you know, my father, my mother, myself, and my sister, a lot, and, you know, visually the cultural context will be there, but, you know, you don't get long treatises on the rise of modernism and the Holocaust or the Cold War in the film. It's about the nuclear family disintegrating and the causes and consequences of that.
And he became this, you know, not only important architect, but, you know, architect in parts of the Cold War. How does it feel to inherit that legacy? What do you do with that?
Well, there's a lot of irony in that. When working on the film, I made a pilgrimage across the country to film buildings that he had worked on. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to find one of these super hardened missile silos that were designed to protect MX missiles, which were the most massive of the weapons of mass destruction that came out in the 1980s. And so those missiles have since been decommissioned due to the SALT treaty ticks, but the silos are still in the ground in Wyoming, north of the Air Force base there, and you can find them. And so I went to film one of these silos, you know, expecting to see this sort of amazing feet of engineering, and it was just a concrete slab in the ground. And what I later discovered was that a lot of the work that that Weidlinger Associates did was theoretical, and it was never actually built.
Huh.
Because by the time early 1980s rolled around, there was less emphasis on nuclear weapons, and Congress did not appropriate the money for building silos to house MX-IBCBMs, the result of which MX-ICBMs were put in old repurposed Minuteman silos, which were completely vulnerable to Soviet attack. So there was this like amazing kind of theoretical shell game that went on for 30 years of how to hide missiles and protect nuclear assets, and a huge amount of pressure and time and effort was spent on it, but very little was actually built in the end.
Fascinating. The whole book is fascinating. The book is called The Restless Hungarian by Tom Weidlinger. Where can people go to find out more about it and to find out more about you?
Well, I've been actually writing about the process of working on the project for several years, and there's a blog called restlesshungarian.com where there's articles, videos, photographs, and then also if you go to the blog, there's a prominent button that says buy the book, and you click on that, and that will take you to Amazon. You can also buy an audio book and an ebook, and so yeah, all the options are there.
Thanks so much, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Nadine Epstein, editor-in-chief of Moment magazine and the author of Elie Wiesel, An Extraordinary Life and Legacy, Writings, Reflections, and Photographs. Our playout this morning comes from the Eurovision contest, and it's Israeli contestant Kobi Marimi, the song Home, who sang it, well, he sang it, that is, at home in Israel. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a Lag BaOmer of joy, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Caught up in this moment here, my heartbeat stops. I've been running barefoot to the mountain. Nothing comes as easy as it goes. I can hug the water when it snows. I feel the sun upon my skin, and I am someone, I am someone. You pulled my heart, I took it in. It made me someone, I am someone. And now I'm done, I'm coming home. I used to listen to the way they talk, counting down the minutes from the ticking clock. I feel the sun upon my skin, and I am someone, I am someone. You pulled my heart, I took it in. It made me someone, I am someone. And now I'm done,
I'm coming home was so far, collecting scars I refuse. Another touch won't be.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.